Souls in Translation, written by Paul Buell, read by Doug Storm and Shauna Ritter. An aging new leftist recalls his relatives.
Steigt euch, ihr alle, wer ist geschlafen, in der Hingerleben ist in Neut. Der Geist, er kocht und rief zu Waffen, in Schlachtens Vieren ist er gereiht.
What comes to mind is a memory within a memory. My aunts and uncles clinging to something precious. Here's the scene. At the end of the New Year's Eve party, 10 or 20 relatives, Jews, middle-aged and older, the women gather in one corner, raise their drinks and sing the Internationale, in Yiddish, naturally. Section 1. Los Angeles. Ring Lardner Jr. If the phone rings, it's Kate. Tell her to wait until I put in my hearing aid. She's writing her memoir and checking the facts. I was her favorite writer, and she asked for me. It's a big story in my writing life. My dad was an alcoholic. Everybody knows that. He would disappear for a week at a time. He did not want to be that way. For me, Hollywood. Then my older brother dies in Spain, reminding me. There are more important things than writing films. We drank a lot, and I proposed to Jiggy, princess of the German-American left. It made my first wife awfully angry. We were through. Then the war, a happy marriage, and the blacklist. We all drifted out of the party. The luckiest ones, me included, wrote for Robin Hood. MASH turned out to be a hit, even if Pauline Kael pretended that I did not write it. I was lucky to work for a little while with Muhammad Ali. The editors ruined the film. Do you think I should rejoin the party?
Joan Scott. My mother flirted with everything in pants. I was one of twins, and she was convinced Hollywood wanted twins. We did not get far. Suddenly, I was married to a psychotic soldier. When I got rid of him, it was 1946, and I wanted to be a communist. The communists were not so sure they wanted me. I met the man I loved, a producer of left-wing movies, and then he was blacklisted. We quit the U.S. We had wonderful friends in London. We met the Queen. He never stopped wanting to go back, but too much had changed in Hollywood. And then he died. I got a job writing Lassie. Finding new plots was the problem. These dogs were supposed to be brilliant. Go, Lassie, bring me a different tool. I got on with Walt Disney, writing a live feature. Uncle Walt invited me into the screening room to watch the final cut. It was dreadful. How was it? He asked. I said, you've done it again, Walt. Later on, I was Mickey Cohn's dinner partner. He was dying of cancer and never touched me. He liked the company.
John Weber. The party made me mass leader. I got a start as a street orator and moved on to strikes and demonstrations. We cadre had a lot of quiet jokes about the leadership. How many more poods of grain were produced last year in the great Soviet Union? Many, many poods, comrade. And so on. So I was the guy to go to Hollywood in 38 to create a party school. The main idea was fundraising. They never understood that Hollywood films, the ones they never stopped attacking as reactionary, could be class-conscious and pro-Russian. My little school had many takers. We had great teachers, some of them fine writers. It all closed down with a pact in 1939, but we prepared the way for the anti-fascism of 1940s Hollywood. I once sat next to young Ronald Reagan. Anybody could tell he was a fake. Later on, I unionized screen readers, something no one had considered. Still later, with the blacklist on, I went to Italy and produced a film with Paul Muni. His health was gone. It was a good film anyway. It never got shown in the U.S. Bernie Gordon. I was lucky in a sense, and also as unlucky as everybody else. Tony Curtis, a trained left-winger who spoke good Yiddish, starred in my first film. He was a deaf prizefighter. I wrote a Western for Raoul Walsh. After that, until the 60s, I could no longer write under my own name. The films were starting to be made overseas. It was a money thing. They got more spectacular as they got sillier. Krakatoa east of Java was one. The real Krakatoa is west of Java. Nobody bothered to check. I was working with producers who treated blacklist talent like cheap hires. We were underpaid, but in Europe, life was good. My best work was a horror film about a creature from outer space whose killing spree had to be stopped. At the end, he begs for his life. He is unique, irreplaceable. They kill him anyway. Robert Bobby Lees. My folks had money. We had a grand house in San Francisco, just off the Presidio. Then came 1929. The family money was soon gone. I headed for L.A. and UCLA, then dropped out. I could not afford to continue. Thanks to Robert Benchley, I made a breakthrough. He made comedy shorts, and I could write. My first and last Oscar was a miniature for a short feature. Then, more luck lay ahead. Lou Costello was a real reactionary. But what timing the guy had. Bud Abbott was better. He had no politics, and he knew how to play the straight man. Desi Arnaz was a smart guy, no lefty like Lucy, but not against, really. He had the big idea. Let's do television. I was all set. Then came the committee. Lucy slipped through, thanks to connections. Not me. I turned out all right, except for a divorce. Lassie, Flipper, Daktari. Same plot, same animal friend, same bad guy. More or less. A threat to the animal was a threat to the kids. Sometimes a threat to the environment. The message got clearer in time. I never could use my own name. That was okay, too. I was murdered by a lunatic who cut off my head. A plot that could have been used by Hollywood. Dick Powell. I had guidance from older radicals around here. Radio writing was a big break. The Life of Riley was perfect for me. I heard Bill Bendix's wife say, "I don't know how you do it. He's just like that at home." When I moved up from radio to TV, my left-wing pals suggested the next big thing. We start a union for the new medium. It was 1950, and we didn't stand a chance. But we didn't know that. SAG President Ronald Reagan was against us. We thought, so what? We unionized a few shows, mostly on Dumont. We had the Goldbergs, a big radio hit in the past. Then came the subpoenas. Our union was busted. I was in trouble. After a while, I got back to working. Not in my own name. But it got better for me. Hogan's Heroes, of all things. Practically everybody on the show was a lefty, except for the star. And as it came out later, he was a sex addict. We made fun of him on set, not for the sex, but for his politics. He knew it, and was good-natured. I made a living. We supported the left causes. Now I'm dying from the cancer. Carlton Moss. You would not know me from my biggest non-credit credit, The Negro Soldier, 1944. I wrote the script, but my name is absent. Why We Fight had one boss who took all the credit, the big ego, Frank Capra. Not that the film was perfect anyway. No black man lifts a gun, which for the time was predictable. There was no need to blacklist me. Being black was enough. They did it anyway. William Allen, take one. My father was a monster. We called him Momser when he wasn't home. My mother promised we could run away. Then one day she said, "Billy, I let you down. I'm pregnant again." I left home the next day at 15 and found an acting job. There I was in Baltimore. But like a million other kids, I was already thinking of Hollywood. William Allen, take two. I drove Orson Welles from New York to Hollywood. Just the two of us. He sat in the back. There were no freeways, even an hour from Los Angeles. He made me the narrator of Citizen Kane. That's how people know me. But all they saw was the back of my head. Then I was a fighter pilot. Then I wrote a great radio show, How Psychologists Could Help Troubled Kids. Then the Red Scare and the Choice. Could I give a few names to get back to work? I don't feel too bad about it. Soon I was making horror films. They were barely scripted. The monster, my monster, appealed for human understanding. Even my space aliens were smarter than the humans. I owned a racehorse and a mansion. I had wives and girlfriends. They had psychoanalysts. I had psychoanalysts. Now I get along in this trailer, selling subscriptions over the phone to the L.A. Times. William Marshall. They called me Blackula, a little joke. I was happy to be a hit in Hollywood at last, for a little while, thanks to urban audiences. I started out in Gary, Indiana, with a church choir, then on to New York, where Paul Robeson found me. For years, I lived at the Harlem YMCA. It looked like I would be in movies, except the blacklist time came. They needed an angry African now and then. I was okay playing that. The money wasn't bad. Otherwise, nothing in Hollywood. I could get theater work in Paris. It was good to be there in the 1960s. What marches we had. Then Hollywood needed another kind of angry black man. Not much afterward. Mostly theater clinics and Watts. And a good teaching job with college kids. I always admired the ones who burned down the bank. That was in Riverside. Roy Huggins. I call myself a Republican Marxist. I was mostly a mystery writer, and the CP had some great writers. Then it was crunch time. I had left them anyway. TV was my game, and I jumped right in. James Garner was just a swimsuit model when I met him, but a master of irony. In my hands, that is. In all my stories, the situation was hopeless, but not disastrous. The Western reinvented. And then we made him the best detective in TV history. What a cast! Pretty soon I was out of the show. Cancer caught up before I could finish my bitter memoir. David Platt. In the 40s, I was at the Freiheit. I wrote a Yiddish biography of Charlie Chaplin. He was an orphan, you know. When they asked if he might be Jewish, he said, "I won't deny it." Chaplin was a god to us. The Cold War was too much for me. In the 50s, I moved over to the Forwards. It was a good job, and I wrote about movies. My personal film collection goes to a library. Morris Fisher. It was just farm country when we got here in the 1930s. Jews abandoning Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, even Denver. We all wanted to get out of the factories and work for ourselves. But we also had, many of us, two other things. We spoke Yiddish. We read Yiddish. We also sang Yiddish when we got the chance. And we were all progressives. There were Jews who were not. Some were even Republican. One thing divided us bitterly. We supported migrant workers' strikes, no matter they were Mexicans. The anti-left Jews wondered why we would risk ourselves for those people, when all the world hates a Jew. They wouldn't come to hear Paul Robeson sing in San Francisco, that's for sure. Later on, the 1950s, we all supported Stevenson. It was a Jewish thing to do. Then, the 1960s, the kids from Petaluma went to San Francisco State, took LSD, went skinny dipping and screwed like crazy. A goodly number also joined the left, even if they lost the Mamelution. A lot of our kids remain progressive. I.A. Ronch. I'm 86, and they named a poetry club after me. They thought I'd be dead by now. I was tubercular when I was young. The doctors said, "Move west." From New York, I made it 100 miles. At first, surrounded by Gentiles, I was terrified. Then I realized they were just people, I got well and went back to New York, 1920. The labor Zionists had me teaching Yiddish language and literature on Long Island. Then the communist culture started up. I wrote a Yiddish biography of Ruthenberg, the communist leader who died young. I was a teacher and a poet, also a novelist pretty soon. When I got to L.A. in 1945, the streets smelled like flowers. That didn't last long. We all lived around Fairfax Avenue, where the Russians and the synagogues are now. We kept the left-wing group together for 40 years. Can I give you my novel?
Minnie Rifkin. Don't mind Sam when he comes over. He is bitter and loud, but he's not a well man. We made lots of mistakes, but we kept together. You'll go with us to La Brea Park later. Every Saturday, they show old movies. But before that, we have a little picnic. And not far from where we sit, the other groups, anti-communist socialists, anti-everything anarchists. The groups don't sit together, but we wave at each other. We are all just old cultured Jews. After we eat, we all go to the movies.
Section 2. Miami Beach, 1979 to 1982.
Mary Zackheim. I was always a union shop steward. But if you want to get something done, don't stand in the front row when they take the picture. You train the young people. That's the way to do things. Sasha Zimmerman, his boss, Dubinsky, was against us. But his door was always open to me. We settled problems right away. The bosses got away with nothing. Will you sit with me a while longer? Have another gefilte fish. Next time, it will be Jenny Welt. Sylvia Sidney. Take a look at that photo over there. Our convention, 1931. We had a needles trade union of our own, and it was red. But we had to go back to the ILG with our heads down. We have one rule in our book circle. You have to say something new about Yiddish literature. And do not talk about your aches and operations. Nina Goldstein. I was a shop girl on vacation. This would be the 1920s. He was already a manager in the Catskills. He was very progressive, but quiet. He gave a lot of money to the movement. Down here, we had events for everything the movement needed. When he died, a blonde pianist and scholar of Yiddish music pursued me, sang to me in concerts, even while his wife was dying at home. I said, don't embarrass me like that. But when she died, he married me, and we published his music books. He used to say, I owe it all to my mother, but his first wife must have helped.
Pinchas Caruso. 92 years last week. How do I look? Back in 1920, we wanted to labor Zionist daily. Someone had to be manager. That was me. We lasted only a few years. The movement was never strong in this country, and never a workers' movement. Not mostly. It was mostly middle class and not too socialistic. We had some of the great writers, like David Pinsky, but they soon made Aliyah. We raised money. Meyer Zackheim. When there's a concert or a lecture, we need to mobilize. People are old and sick and dying. But our paper gives us something to live for. If we are the last Yiddish socialist generation, we will carry on until the end. Do you want to interview my wife? Someone called her a pepper pot of a woman. She's deaf, and she yells.
Mary Zackheim. I travel while I still can, and I like to go to Russia. The young people, they sit out at night in the cafes. Some have guitars and they sing, boyfriends and girlfriends, just like anywhere else. When people say life in Russia is terrible, I say it's not heaven and it's not hell, just ordinary. That's why we have a friendship society. Florence Glassman. We were in our 20s and just married, or not quite married. Margaret Sanger's birth control clinic opened up in Brownsville. She was not even a socialist anymore, but we were eager to go. 10 years later, we had children and our neighbors could not pay the rent. We organized. We beat back the landlords. Where were we women once more so prominent in the left? During the war, the men were gone. We did war relief. Faye Gardner. I came here in the 1950s, before the big towers went up, before my friends would arrive. We wanted a place to be close in our politics and culture. We had wonderful times. We always supported the progressives and opposed the wars. Now we are all dying. The young people are Cuban and they hate us.
Section 3, The Yiddish World. Pisak Novik. I was born in Brest-Litovsk in 1891. It was a Yiddish town. Only the upper class spoke Russian, but the rabbis were famous across the Pale. My father had a miserable little store. There were hopes I would be a rabbi. In the yeshiva, I already knew the text. I would sneak off to the fields to read a novel in Hebrew. I came across a Yiddish paper. It was against the Tsar. I found my way to a secret discussion group in the woods. At 15, I was a member of the Bund and a Marxist. I wanted to write, and I did, for my friends, a satire and a letter to a Yiddish paper. I had begun. By 1907, I was working in a cigarette holder factory. I was not bad at it. In my mind, I was already in Warsaw. I went, but I could not get a job. In a small town near home, I was working again. Our little group read Yiddish and sang songs long into the Saturday nights. Soon I earned enough to get a train ticket to Zurich. Our Jewish students' club there was wonderful. We drank beer and went to operas and heard great revolutionary speakers. I was drawn to Trotsky. He was not consistent, but a better speaker than Lenin. The Russian draft called me home. I chose America. Soon I was working in a raincoat factory, gluing things. My uncle brought me to a better job in Pittsburgh. His Victrola was playing in New York. Katz wie in a Kessel Group. New York is cooking like a whirlpool in a kettle. I had to go there. I wrote an indignant letter to the Yiddish socialist, so they hired me. Then to Denis Wild. I became the managing editor while auditing courses at Columbia. With the October Revolution, I went back to Russia. I was hungry all the time, and the Bund was against the Bolsheviks. So I left with the poet David Einhorn. In New York, I heard about the new Morgan Freiheit. Here, the energy was all in the young communists. By now, the socialists were the bureaucrats in the unions. Or they were kindly old-timers who history passed by. Moish Olgin hired me, and I could not resist. Olgin had a PhD. He was a scholar of Russian literature. There was no one like him in the Jewish left. We were the most literate of the Yiddish newspapers. We allowed no Americanized words. We supported the labor movement and improved our readers with fine poetry and fine cultural reviews. Along with the paper came the workers' theater, very fine, and also workers' choruses. We were all poor, but young and talented and revolutionary. We also stupidly supported everything the Russians did. 60 years later, I looked back and said to myself, if I could choose between the communists or the Bund again, I would have no difficulty choosing. but the choice would not be the communists. Sam Lipson. They called me Vater Shepso, Yiddish, for Uncle Sam. I wrote 23 books of humor, mostly folkish, labor, and left. I got here from Russia in 1908. A story from my young days. I was introducing a speaker in 1910. Someone from the audience said, "Explain socialism to us." I said, "I am like the clerk in the bagel shop. You want to know how bagels are made? Here, I give you the baker." I was trying to say, "Wait for the main speaker." In the Yiddish Humor Weekly, they wrote that a green yingo, a new immigrant boy, was being funny. I like that. Pretty soon, I was writing a little for them. We had our own magazine, Der Humorist, in 1920. It did not last. Then came a new daily, Morgenfreiheit, with beautiful Yiddish. I joined some of the greatest writers of the day, Moishe Lieb Halpern, Mani Lieb, and the greatest of Yiddish humorists, Moishe Nader. We published many volumes of Nader's work, also the collected works of Die Zeit, Morris Vinchevsky. I was more the jokester, still the warm-up act. This time for high literature and high politics. We were young and so full of life that if the Allerton Avenue co-ops had no elevator, we never thought about getting old and weak. The writers and editors around me, later on, most of them gave back their party cards. Not me. Never me. Meiersticker. We were the Insul, the island, away from politics. We were the only generation of Yiddish experimentalists. Before us, socialists. After us, no Yiddish generation. I made my money translating into Yiddish for the Forwards and the Tog. The Old Man on the Sea, I translated it. I'm glad you came this week. Next week, it's the Workman's Circle home in the Bronx. I'm not coming back. Zoltan Dieck. We organized big anti-fascist events around the country, all the way from the 1920s and Horthy to the end, 1944. Who were the big names? We called them the two Bellas, Bela Lugosi and Bela Bartok. We didn't have to watch the movies Lugosi made. We could listen to Bartok. But Lugosi wrote bigger checks. Later he became addicted to drugs. He wanted to be something beyond a monster. Anthony Bimba. In 1921, I came to the U.S. A college in Indiana was open to us and friendly. We took courses, but aimed to make a revolution. I was always an editor, and became an editor again, this time, New York. Young Lithuanians were building social halls, and they liked Russia. Was there a communist who would write the history of American labor? No. So I wrote it in English, 1927, and it was published. Was there a communist who could write the history of the Molly Maguires? No. So I wrote it. In 1932, the book came out. And then I had finished with writing history. A daily paper in Lithuanian was work enough. Our proletarians needed guidance. Also, entertainment. Now I am almost finished. The paper is a weekly. We are in Ozone Park, it seems like forever. Herbert Gutman. I was guilty of being a counselor at Camp Kinderland somewhere back in the 40s. We sang songs in Yiddish and taught the kids to tend campfires. Our campers had their first brush with something like sex. Here's a story about us at Camp Kindering. They were the socialist anti-communist. But we both taught the kids Shalom Aleichem. We counselors would look across the lake at night, and the Kindering counselors looked back at us, and we waved to each other. Phil Raymond. The party sent me to Detroit in 1922. Organize the Auto Workers Union. We did pretty well with the ethnics. Ukrainians, Slovenes, Finns, and so on. They had one big problem. They wanted to stay hidden in their social halls and throw banquets. Being an open communist was a danger. We had to bring them out, and we did. By 1930, we organized around current grievances. not for something far away like Russia. Then it was 1936 and the party said, "We're pulling you out. We need to make peace with the new crowd. That is, the Reuters and the others who were not making a revolution." I wasn't too sorry. The fraternal movement had money, and I pushed paper around. The dramatic part of my life was over. Fred Wright. I was a musician by trade. It was hard times, and I worked in a clip joint. A rich guy would be kept drinking all night and get the bill in the morning, $500. Then I got a job on a big ship, the rich dancing their way to Europe. I was always a little bit of an artist, not fine art. I fell into drawing comics, first for the Army and then the Maritime Union paper. One day in 1949, they told me to draw Reds as rats. I said, "No, I won't do that." Then I went to work for UE News and never quit. I get lazy and redraw old cartoons most of the time. My proletarians are not big-muscled heroes. They make jokes about how they need to get through the day and stage an occasional, small revolt. Fred Pohl. The Futurians Club in New York, 1938. A bunch of left-wing teenagers. All Jewish, but me. Isaac Asimov and a handful of us less talented kids who would, anyway, write books by the dozens. We thought Russia had a more scientific civilization. Later on, we didn't think so. But we still lived in a crazy, stupid society. We made a living with a lot of steady typing. We met young writers and helped them. We had parties and fanzines and fan conventions. Serious writers, important writers, considered us nothing. We might as well have been writing romance novels. There was a big split over the Vietnam War, with the bug-eyed monster writers against us peaceniks. And then we got middle-aged, and Isaac died. He was the one who got respect. The rest of us had readers. Science fiction was a way to tell a story. The story was, humans, you better wake up. Martin Birnbaum. Another garment worker once said, "Martin, if I was a poet, I would write just like you." The party mistrusted me. I was too much a lyric poet. But I stayed in the shop, and I stayed in the party. I also stayed in Yiddish, though my English is perfect. Someone said, "The ghetto is warm." Yiddish was my ghetto when there were readers for my poems. I was always a little bit of a bohemian. I'm living now with a lady who does not know Yiddish, the widow of a wealthy Philistine. I get up in the middle of the night writing poems. Who will publish them? Who will read them? Nobody. Lee Baxendall. I came from Oshkosh, where overalls were made by the millions and machine tool factories thrived. My dad owned a greeting card company. I dreamed of being a bohemian. And pretty soon I was in Madison among a pack of intellectuals, all of them Jewish but me. Then Manhattan. The theater was great. We were reinventing Brecht. My play was Potsy. Then Summers on the Cape. Everyone nude as Floyd Dell in 1915. Free love reinvented. Free beaches for our thousands. Naked to the elements. I changed the name of my picture magazine from Clothed with the Sun to Naked and Natural. The end came when our kids became teenagers and begged their parents to put their clothes back on. Solon de Leon. It's not true what they used to say. I was not disowned in 1908 for challenging the labor theory of value. Dad was still editing the Daily People, and I was a loyal party member, but the IWW threw him out, which threw us out. What was the point of the SLP going on? I joined the Socialist Party Left with my pal Lou Frayne. He had a tragic life ahead. Moscow, Mexico, New York, Yellow Springs, me. I stayed here the whole time, and found smaller things to do for labor and the left. I had a happy life, a normal life. Jerry Trauber. In the dark days of McCarthyism, I took over a going business. The older generation was dying off. Men and women who went through the first blacklist in the early 20s, when the Bureau of Investigation, not yet the FBI, went after them. Back then, Jewish communists worked in the shops and lived in tenements. Later on, they called themselves the Fortunate Generation, this after being blacklisted twice in a lifetime. They knew their friends for 50 years and ended up in Florida. They kept Yiddish alive as long as they lived. I cut their stones. A few were foolish enough to ask me to include hammers and sickles. After that, it was a shiner und besser Welt, a more beautiful and better world. Every socialist wants that.
Sarah Gudelman. What was the biggest thing in my life? Shalom Aleichem. On the last day of his life, I was his volunteer nurse. If he didn't die in the night, he would have died in my arms, right here in the Bronx. Later on, I met the man I wanted to marry, a sculptor. We had a boy. He ran across the street from school and he was run over, dead. I told my husband that I wanted to die. He said, if you kill yourself, then I will too. I could be a teacher of Yiddish, so I joined the party. They brought me a gold pen to sign with. It was gold-plated, anyway. This was a life. We had many friends. In the Shalom Aleichem co-ops, we gave the poor children mittens for winter. The anti-communists wouldn't do it. We kept Yiddish alive for two generations. Now my friends are all dead. And my husband, too. Will you sit next to me while we talk? Can we hold hands?
Section 4. New England. Al Sisti. Down in Olneyville, where I worked, the rabbit fur was so thick it covered our faces, and our mouths felt like muck. The old-timers were not so eager to strike. The war ended and the factories got smaller. I switched over to steel and became a union reformer. I remember at a national convention we made trouble. The old guys chanted, Johnny come lately. We were slower in small places, slower in forming unions. My wife said, you love the union more than me. Our kids were gone, and I was alone. I have my troubles with Parkinson's. When I take the pills, I can't give speeches. My words get all tangled up. Give me a bullhorn, and you'll hear me talking. I'm not finished yet. Larry Spitz. I grew up in a poor Jewish neighborhood. We were looking for jobs like anybody in the 30s. A foreman would throw a spindle on the street and say, die for him, the first 20 get the jobs. We humiliated ourselves for those jobs, and you know what he wanted from the girls. A few years later, I was an actor in a small-time touring company of the left, Pins and Needles. What a show, even if I didn't have a singing part. We played Woonsocket, where the working class was so poor they couldn't afford radios, and most still spoke French on the street. Textile workers had a new union set up after the riots of the 34 strike. They made me a leader until I came back from the war when they called me a Red. I was finished in Woonsocket. Pretty soon I was a steel union leader, defeated by the union machine. They sent me to run a district the rest of my time. The exciting part of my life was over. Edwin Brown. My father, who also worked in a factory, said, if there is a union, join that union. And that's what I did. Worked my way up. I wasn't for the communists, but I didn't hate them. We had Catholic labor schools, but they didn't make much trouble. There weren't really Reds to exclude. The children of union factory workers here left the tenements and found their way to college. The sick kids got hospitals and mental care. These are things we accomplished, even if the factories are almost gone now and the memories are slipping away. Robert Derdurian. I saw the Turks kill my parents, and I learned that Lenin is a strong man. Later I ran for lieutenant governor here in Rhode Island, 1932. We had a movie theater where most of us lived every Saturday, Soviet films from Armenia. Our peak, Armenia Relief, World War II. After that, we got weaker. Luigi Nadella. Guido, my older brother, he pulled the handles on the looms. He started the big textile strike. I was the one to bring in support. We got together a bunch of girls and went from mill to mill shouting, come out, come out. Italians had all the worst jobs. When we could get jobs at all, we were kept out of housing in some towns. The owners, they wanted to drop our wages. Back to what they were before the war. We said no.
The mills were laying off already. The odds were all against us, but we held off for 6 months. We raised 50 cents benefits per striker. We set up 13 restaurants, one meal, sandwiches and milk for the kids, who looked healthier than before the strike. That was 1922. I joined the Young Communist League and the Anti-Fascist Front Risorgimento Club. After that, for me, the Barbers Union. And always the Communist Party.
Margaret Jenks. My mother worked at the Lonsdale Mills. I remember her saying she came to the U.S. right after McKinley was shot. She got $3 per week, 6 in the morning till 6 at night. Then she got married and lived in the company houses. Here's what she said. I can remember all the names of the people there. We were all close. When they had a wake, people would loan things to each other. We used to laugh. Every wake had the same table and the same pictures on the wall. Rose Bell. I used to carry union cards in my apron pocket. I wore a dress with two big pockets. The people who would get pushed around, they would say to me, they wish the boss would drop dead. I answered, don't say that. I have something in my pocket that would fix him. What? They asked. Mary Smith. We went to hear Norman Thomas in the 1920s, right up to 1932, the big election. The crowds in Providence, immigrant workers and their descendants still in the factories, treated him like a god. Afterwards, we listened to that other radical, the priest, on the radio, denouncing the bankers. Father Coughlin, that's his name. We Irish, we loved him.
Al McAloon. My grandfather, he owned a funeral parlor right near the downtown. When an IRA supporter died, this would be in the 1910s, 1920s, he sent the casket home to Ireland. Would be full of rifles. Ray Bell. Only two of us from the Lincoln Battalion are still around. The Spanish Civil War? If we'd been given the chance, we could have stopped fascism. In 1948, we figured it was time for a big political move. Get Henry Wallace on the ballot. I collected 634 signatures by myself. But when I went into working-class homes, I saw something new. Now they had new rugs and bedroom sets and real refrigerators for the first time. We were going to get 5 million votes? I don't think so. That started the downfall of the left in America. Mitten international steigt auf ihr Arbeitsleid. Afterward. I owe these poems to several overlapping experiences in a life of scholarship and political activity. The first is a reading of Spoon River Anthology, as much as forgotten since high school English class, but recovered 50 years later. And reclaimed as one native Midwesterner, listening and responding to another. The second is my field work in oral history, recording the lives of old people nearing the end of their lives, and looking back without much need to cover their tracks. My interviewees have a few very special qualities. A large number of them represent the trailing penumbra of the Yiddish-speaking Jewish left in the United States, in Greater New York, Miami Beach, and Los Angeles. Others made their names in Hollywood, but remained just as Jewish in their own way. Yet another portion found themselves in blue-collar Rhode Island, with another disappearing communal past to draw upon. They all have, inevitably, myself in common, because, during the period from the later 1970s until the middle 1990s, I happened to be the one asking the questions. But their lives speak for themselves. Edgar Lee Masters, the downstate Illinois author of the anthology, initially chose to publish his poems under a pseudonym. in the free-thinking Reedy's Magazine in nearby St. Louis, afterward escaping from a Chicago law office to the apex of literary bohemia at the Chelsea Hotel in Manhattan. Perhaps he needed to establish a distance between himself and his subjects. I like to think of Masters as a counterpart to Art Young, among the greatest of socialist cartoonists, who hailed from a small town in Wisconsin and was among the most melancholy of the artists who suffered the disappointments of 20th century American progress. The two figures, more or less in the same generation, speak to us today. They offered me the inspiration for this small collection and for a non-career in left-wing comic art, created by much the same melancholy a century later. Neither Masters nor Young gave up on life, American life, but they took the measure of its deeper, disguised realities. Madison, Wisconsin, winter, 2020-21. This has been Souls in Translation, written by Paul Buell. Read by Doug Storm and Shauna Ritter. Audio production by Doug Storm. Copyright 2021 by Paul Buell.